Welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. Within striking distance of Hebden Bridge, as dusk falls, accompanied by his dog Frida, radio producer, presenter and writer Horatio Clare takes me on a slow walk close to his home in an area known as Hardcastle Crags. The sky above us fills with insects and the birds and bats that feed upon them. Always alert to the nature that surrounds us, we don't walk far before we stop, so Horatio can point out some creature I have not as yet spotted and can't identify. In a candid conversation, Horatio shares his enthusiasms for slow walking and how it makes compelling radio listening, as well as talking about his writing, about nature and travel, and how walking through the landscape are critical to his work. Okay, so I'm glad you've got a compass on your jacket.
It doesn't work. it's working. That's the first time it's ever worked.
So, shall we start with a slow walk? Tell us a little bit, how did that come about?
So the first slow walk across the Brecon Beacons, as it were, it was the Black Mountains along Hatchrell Ridge between Glantoni and Hay. And it came about because they rang me up and said, would you be interested? We want to try out something called slow radio. You just walk along and say what you see and tell us a bit about the sort of writing and thinking about the area. And so, partly from memory and partly from hastily reading up, I got an impression of kind of depth of that area, so Kilvert and Chatwin, David Jones. And we had a wonderful walk, and the BBC hadn't done it before, so they pioneered sound recording technology, which is a man called Richard Andrews, and Richard designed a backpack which holds a microphone on a stand, a microphone cover anyway, and he records his footsteps with a handheld mic. I've got a radio mic, and all in all, he's recording seven tracks as we go along. And so if you listen to it on proper speakers, it sounds absolutely immaculate. You're there. And that one was slow radio in that I think the producer felt obliged to put in lots of footsteps and lots of ambience. And as a former radio producer myself, I did see that that was an interesting call and experimental and good for them.
So they added material to it.
We recorded all day and then they cut it down to 4 hours. They had some interviews with people like Tom Bulow, wonderful artists and writers who live in the area. There was more to it. You still really did feel you were walking quite a long way.
But were you walking a long way?
You must have walked 10 miles, I suppose, 10, 15 miles.
And did they just record it on one day?
We recorded it as it happened, yeah. Yeah, yeah, it was good. But the second one was a bit different because that was the Bark Walk. So we were covering 230 miles and we had 5 days to do it in. So we essentially walked five times along that route and drove between them. And that was wonderful because they were shorter programmes. They were half hours and the last one was a 45 minute. You get footsteps, but it's mostly the sound, what we came across, what I found and thought, and Lindsay Kemp, the producer, cut in wonderful, wonderful extracts from Bach. And so the whole thing became a really magical experience to do. We knew as we were doing it that it was a bit special. Then as we came into Lübeck and finally got to the end of it, I felt, I think Lindsay felt too, that we were as close to Bach's ghost as, you know, you were going to get, really. The ghost of a 20-year-old young writer.
You were definitely in his footsteps.
There were sections of it when we were definitely in his footsteps, and other bits where, because not much is known, about his route, where we almost certainly weren't. But that was part of the fun of it, really.
Can you tell my listeners a little bit about why Bach made that journey?
Yes. So he was Anstad, and he was a young man of 20, You know, he tested out their organ for him, and he'd been given a good job, a decent salary, and he was clearly deeply frustrated with it. The consistory, his bosses, were very conservative, the congregations were very conservative, the musicians weren't good enough, the organ was good, and Bach would later be reprimanded for adding in improvisations and difficult bits and flights of fancy to hymns and cantatas that he must have felt he was just banging out for these people. And there was a question about a girl who was in the organ loft with him, a mysterious woman. Some accounts say she sang with the choir, others not so clear. Could have been his future wife, isn't known. And then he fell out very badly with a bassoonist called Geiersbach, who he clearly hated. And it was mutual. And Bach in public had called him a Zippelfagottist, which I think is best translated as a prick of a bassoonist. And Geiersbach had been to a wedding, and with five friends lay in wait for Bach in the town square, the market square, outside his church, and assaulted him with a cudgel, which he smashed Bach in the face with. And Bach went armed, so he drew his dagger, or rapier, and fought the guy off. And Geiersbach would later produce a shirt full of holes and say that this was evidence that Bach had tried to kill him. And so when he put in for leave, just for 4 weeks' leave, I think they were probably very relieved to grant it to him. But he appointed a cousin to take over his duties and was gone for 4 months. And so he set off in late October of 1705, age 20, for Lübeck, where Dietrich Buxtehude, the great organist, the most interesting and revolutionary figure of his time, who was then very old, had inaugurated a series of concerts, evening concerts, and concerts running up to Advent music, which were drawing musicians from all over Europe. We know Handel went, of course.
Not the best time of year to start a walk of 200 plus kilometres.
Actually, it was lovely. I mean, because we did it about a week later than he did. It was perfect, beautiful autumn weather. It was on his way back in 1706 in February, a walk about which we know nothing, that it must have been brutal. But anyway, so he went, and we followed him, and all he said about it when asked was he wanted to learn something of his art from this man. And, of course, Buxtehude was using the Marienkirche in Lübeck in an entirely new way. He was using galleries, he was spreading the sound all around, and he was doing these extraordinary compositions. So Bach went, certainly via Lüneburg, although there's no record of it, but he must have gone, because you can't miss it. And he'd been taught there by the great Georg Böhm, it seems certain, possibly. Oh, look, there's a frog. A little beautiful golden black-eyed frog. He went via Lüneburg, and then he would have had to have gone round the Harz Mountains. He certainly went up the old salt road to Lübeck. So for quite a bit of it, we were in his footsteps. It was an amazing experience for me because I didn't know a great deal about him, and I didn't know a great deal about classical music, but I'd been learning like mad. And in fact, I've just finished a book about it called Something of His Art, which will be out in the autumn from Little Toller.
OK, so you've worked in radio, and you've created programmes now in slow radio. Is that more of a passion than the writing?
To be strictly fair, I created programmes, as it were, when I was working on The Verb with Ian McMillan, and before that on Front Row, I was a producer. But this time I've been a presenter, and really, I it's the producer that creates the programme. Yes, I love radio. In fact, I did a bit of moonlighting recently for an American radio station that broadcasts live from London, Sirius XM2. Millions of listeners across the States, but I did as a producer again for Norina Hertz, who was the presenter, just to have the fun of the people, really, the books, the ideas, the sort of companionable and wonderful intellectual stimulation of it. I adore all that. Whereas in writing, even though I teach, which does provide a lot of stimulation, the basic fact of it is it's you in an empty house.
I guess that's a pretty lonely...
It can be, although I am quite a busy sort of writer, so there tends to be quite a bit on with travel and other things.
Well, you're quite a restless spirit, aren't you?
I don't know. I just, once you start travel writing, you haven't got much choice, really. I suppose I do like to move, that's right, but I really like to move with my family if possible. So my trips are either quite intense because I'm doing them by myself, or they're marvellous because I take family too. I reckon the ratio is about two trips of me by myself to one with all of us, or at least a certain of us. So, yes, a degree of restlessness, I suppose. Although, Rebecca, my partner, I mean, look, there's, you see the deer?
Oh, wonderful,
A deer and a pheasant.
So we've had deer, pheasant, rabbit and frog so far.
Yes, and there was a sparrowhawk and a buzzard earlier on. Rebecca's, she knows pretty well path of these hills in the 5 years that we've been here. So this is Crimsworth Dean.
And she runs them.
She's a runner and a walker, and she's just unstoppable, really. Whereas I'm much more kind of stroller. I can stroll all day and parts of the night, but I don't... I'm not like that.
Do you stroll to get creative thought and things?
I tend to come into this field when I'm in anguish. So I associate this field either with lovely summer walks or snow walks with my boy, or just coming out here to try and have a talking to with the demons, really. But it's perfect time now. But there are swifts up there.
People talk about this area as the White Witches. Can you perhaps explain a little bit about where we are? I mean,
you're in Hardcastle Crags, which is a wonderful National Trust property in a valley above Hebden Bridge. So we're looking south now towards the buttress and Hepton Stall. And behind that tree is the top of the church tower there where Sylvia Plath is buried. And just on the other side, just over past those telegraph poles and down the other bank is Lumb Bank, Ted Hughes's house, which is now a wonderful Arvon Centre. And yes, it's lousy with writers. Great Amy Liptrot has recently moved here. Benjamin Myers, lives in Mythenroyd and swims near here and walks around here. Zafir Kunil, who's just published his first collection with Faber, is just down there. So yes, there's loads of us, which is lovely. I don't see them much except we run into each other in Nisa or something. And then Hebden is a very unusual conglomeration, really, because you still have proper tractors roaring down the main street. Obviously, local indigenous population, people who can trace their families back here for generations. And then the offcomers, like us, who've come for one reason or another. I've got friends who are architects from London, wanted to live out here and work remotely. Dr. Doug Field, who writes the TLS, teaches at Manchester. They used to call Hepton Stall Granada Village because when Granada was big, a lot of the producers lived up there and the BBC around. And there was a wonderful coming together in the terrible floods of Boxing Day 15 when the town just saved itself from this appalling deluge with almost no outside help. All the populations came together. There's a large gay population, lesbian, which is wonderful. So although I have kind of problems with the north in terms of its darkness and the rain and the endless winters and the frank ugliness of much of it and the horrible way in which the population here, certainly the poor population, is treated by the rich governing south, it does have its marvellous sides. And I have huge respect for the people because they've got to be tough and they are tough and yet they're also so giving. So in the Boxing Day floods, it was amazing. The town just rescued itself. The organisation was phenomenal. And somebody said afterwards, "Are you surprised? Hebden's a town of project managers and alpha women."
No, well, it's a very idyllic spot compared to my little area of South London, that's for sure.
So, I don't know, Greenwich would do me fine. I'd swap with you, Andrew, any time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we have a fair bit of writers and things like that in the territory. So on that writing side of it, have you used walking as a way to overcome blocks or...
Yes, definitely, and to let you into things. The point is, so Roald Dahl said the magic happens at the desk, and he's right. Except that for the spark can happen any time, and it's really difficult to force it, so you have to sort of let it in. So I got the idea for Down to the Sea and Ships in Verona. I was walking around the Adige River on a dark, misty, dank, kind of metal-smelling night in Verona, the opposite of the tourist picture, and I suddenly had been reading Moby Dick, you know, and the second line is better than the first. When my humours get the upper hand of me and it's dank November in my soul, and I have difficulty not knocking strangers' hats off in the street and joining every funeral cortege that passes, I count it high time to go to sea. And I thought, I've got it. And I went straight back to our little flat and emailed Maersk, and I was off.
Well, you found a container ship, and off you went, which wouldn't be most people's choice, would it?
Would it be most people's choice? Yes, I mean, the number of people I've talked to, the novelist Rupert Thompson saw me at a literary festival and he said, "You sod." What a good idea. He would have done that. And lots of artists and photographers have talked about their envy of it. It's perfect, of course, because you've got captive population to write about. And your place is extraordinary, the ship itself. And then the setting of the ocean changes all the time. So you've got an embarrassment of material, really.
And the crew are happy to have you aboard?
They were nonplussed to start with. They didn't know what I was, you know. A working ship and then a kind of writer is a kind of alien confrontation. But once they got it, they were, oh, OK, you're here to tell our story. Then they seemed very happy. Yes, they did. They did. So, yes, walking...
But also you have an enthusiasm for nature too, don't you?
Do I have an enthusiasm for nature? I think that rather understates it, Andrew, to be honest.
Okay.
Nature, I should make it change the question. No, your question is fine. My first children's book, Aubrey and the Terrible Ute, is set in this valley. I called it Woodside Terrace, and it's set absolutely in these particular woods and on these particular moors. And all the characters exist in that there are... little wood ants in Hardcastle Crags. There are little owls. There are tawnies. There's the heron that I see every day. And they're all in it. And it's not just any heron. It's that one, you know. They actually exist. So I suppose the thing that I'm interested in is, from that point of view, is not telling children fables. You know, my superhero has an ability. He's just a normal boy, but anyone can talk to animals. He can hear what they say. And I suppose part of the project of my life as a writer is hearing what the land and the animals say and destroying, if possible, the separation between us and it, or just showing that it's an illusion. So I suppose writing, I used to think, for me, was walking, and the other bit was mostly typing. Yes, I mean, I find writing easy if you know what you want to say, but to know what you want to say, it may help to come out into the world. My now 17-year-old stepson, stepson, said to me, "What's writing anyway?" And I, you know, he doesn't need books, he claims. And I said, "I think, Robin, it is reading, rhythm, and something to say. And certainly, the rhythm and the something to say you can get from the open air, from the world as it is."
Stephen King, I think, said that it was telepathy. Because you pass a message on to...
Yes, well, that makes a lot of sense.
People read what you've read 10, 20 years after you've written it, and that message is still coming through to them.
Yes, that's a wonderful thought. That is a wonderful thought. I suppose all writing in some way is a defiance of death. I think that's part of it, isn't it? Is that you're speaking into a space that's timeless, and is a lot of listening silence, because when you write, you don't know... I mean, maybe it's different for J.K. Rowling, but I doubt it, actually. It's just you and the page. And certainly when you start out, you don't know if anyone will ever read it, which is wonderful, and it's just a feeling I sort of seek to recapture and hold on to, because then it's some conversation between you and something that isn't you, but is a version, perhaps, of you that has sympathies, that's impatient, that wants to hear and not be bored, wants to be entertained. And I think I try and speak to that person. But that could very well be a version of the world as we'd like it to be. You know, I suppose insignificance in some way is all of our fear, which would explain the way, you know, the phone is so addictive and the internet's so addictive because it appears to argue against it grants the possibility of significance. And I suppose it's a battle against that illusion. But, yes, making... which I suppose writing is, making, I guess, ever since the first Neanderthal walked through these crags after the ice had retreated, making has always been what we've done.
There's a big rise in nature writing, isn't there? The intriguing thing is that you being someone who's written around travels, travel writing had a huge rise in popularity in probably, I don't know, the 80s and the 90s. Mm-hmm. People might say that travel writing is not so popular now,
mm-hmm.
but nature writing is in its ascendancy. I mean...
Yes, I mean, you could argue that the two overlap so much that, in fact, it's kind of meaningless branding. I mean, so Will Atkins has just done an extraordinary book about deserts, and one about moors. In the old days, you might have branded it as travel writing, but now they'll probably brand it as nature writing. It's the same book, and the same for the amazing Robert McFarlane. I mean, you could call those travel books, or you could call those nature books. They're place books, they're history books, they're literary books, they're adventures. Yes, I mean, it's all part of the kind of the rise of non-fiction, I think. Yes, nature writing is one of the most exciting and urgent things that British literature has produced for a while. We've got two prongs, really, to our international claim for excellence, and they are children's books and nature books. Of course, there are wonderful novelists and amazing poets, but as genres, as things you can table and brand, nature and children's are huge for very good reasons. So we have 598 species, I think, of bird on the British list. Germany, which is, you know, a third again as bigger or two-thirds bigger, has 100 fewer species. But just because we're out on the edge of the Atlantic and because our scenery is so varied and our landscapes and environments are so varied, we're incredibly blessed in natural terms. And at the same time, because our ludicrous attitude to conservation from the government and from the corporations and from culture, we're all aware that we're losing it, and we're painfully aware of it. And of course, the generation that buys books, who are often the fit retired, they really mind, they understand nature, they know it, most of my readers know it better than I do, and they love it, they mind about it, they want to read about it, and they want to do it.
And for me, I think the thing that obviously strengthens the aspect of walking, that's the best way of enjoying nature, isn't it? Is really walking. You can't drive through it.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And you can cycle through it, but it's a bit of a green blur. Canoeing is good. Canadian canoeing. I went down the Tyvee on a Canadian canoe. That was amazing, because you're probably immersed in it. But no, walking's the way. Yeah, so I think it's about the crisis of modernity, as it were, really. I mean, I think certainly in the younger generations, that the tides of anxiety and a general feeling of kind of crisis in direction, the crisis of the soul, comes about because we are so much of nature. We are part of it. So, yes, look at that swift. I mean, it's just single one now I treasure, you know, just the sight of it, because you think they're still going. And it was Hughes who wrote their back, "The World's Still Turning." We've got a flock of 15 now above us.
Well, I have to say to the listeners is that most of the time we've been talking, you've been staring at the sky.
Well, it's so full. Can you imagine how miserable it would be if we were to stand here for half an hour and see nothing?
And see no birds, yeah, I know. Well, and is this an area for bats too?
Yes, it is a big bat area, because of the midges partly, and we've got owl.
Now that's a bit of a hole. What hole was that?
We've got incredible waterworks up here, and what it was is you've got Gibson Mill down there, got a stream that runs along the valley, and then all the sides here weep with water. So there's a series of reservoirs which start here, and there are about five of them, and they go all the way back through the wood. Most amazing hydroengineering. And in fact, one of them, I think it may be this one, there's an offshoot that goes all the way down there, about half a mile, and then there's a pipe and it comes out in our garden. There's a spring at the back of the house which runs under the house.
Because, I mean, this must have been built a couple of hundred years ago.
Yeah, at least.
You've written a lot and produced radio about walking and walks. So a tough question. Can you narrow it down to a couple of walks that you can recommend our listeners?
Well, my favourite in the world is you go to St Martin's Haven, which is on the very tip of Pembrokeshire, on the southern arm of St Bride's Bay, and it's where you get the boat to Skomer. But you don't get the boat to Skomer. There's a little stile, I think it's Dyfed Wildlife Trust land, and it's certainly Pembrokeshire Coast National Park. It's called the Deer Park, and you just turn left and you walk around the peninsula, or you can go up onto the cliffs and walk to Marlow Sands, and it's utterly beautiful. It makes you want to cry just think about it, actually. It's choughs and greater black-back gulls and shags and shearwaters in the season at night, and gannets, of course, and puffins on the outer islands. But the amazing thing is Middle Isle and Skomer, and they are jewels set in a silver sea. And to the southwest, the clear air and that feeling of a kind of ocean washing a sky, that absolute purity of light and air. And the only places I've come close to that is around Sheepshead, the west of Ireland, near Bantry Bay, where the light is purple blue and unbelievable. That's extraordinary down there. I'd go back there in a heartbeat, but I know the West Wales coast really quite well, that bit of it. So that's definitely one. And then in this country,
doesn't have to be. You travel quite a bit.
Well, Rebecca's an amazing walker. So we've been across the Pyrenees once or twice. We went down the Way of St Francis, which goes down the central spine of kind of Tuscany. down to Assisi. But that's fairly chaotic in that a lot of it doesn't really exist. You kind of put it together as you go as a pilgrim. The Black Mountains, I mean, there's a wonderful walk in our valley, which is the Cwmdi Valley, where you just go up to Penawtmawr and then you walk a great horseshoe up to Castle Dinas and then round and down. And that's a lovely walk for a full day of action. And there's a pub at the top of the valley and another one when you get back down. The Farmer's Arms, Cwmdi, is a great place to begin or end anything. Those are wonderful.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. In this episode, you've heard from Horatio Clare. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we would love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stuck of Rethinking Cities Limited, our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.